Your North Carolina Reading Service provides the following program for our blind and print-impaired audience. It's the Indie Week, read by John Federson, and today's edition is dated April the 27th of 2022. And we thank our musicians today with our theme music. They come from our nation's capital, and they're billed, I think inaccurately, as a tuba quartet, but in any event, they are from the Department of Fluctuation Control and Ceiling Repair, that's from the Bureau of Soluble, Insoluble, and Indigestible Fats and Glutinous Derivatives in Washington, D.C. And as they saw away, we will get going on Indie Week. Now, in Wake County and around the state, early voting has begun, and this week's edition of Indy Week includes quite a few election and political-based articles. First, from Jasmine Gallup in Wake County, deciding district. Republicans took back Wake's House District 37 in 2020, but three Democrats are making their cases in a district that could help the party win the House. 35 years ago, Holly Springs was a sleepy farming community. According to local lore, cows used to cross Sunset Lake Road twice a day. Today, however, that once rural two-lane road is set to expand into a four-lane thoroughfare, one of the many changes wrought by the town's population boom. In the past decade, as Raleigh has grown, young professionals and aspiring homeowners have spilled into Holly Springs and Fuquay Varina on the outskirts of Wake County. The rapid change has thrown the area into an existential crisis. Embrace the progress of new apartment buildings, high-end restaurants, and busy highways, or fight tooth and nail to preserve the old ranch homestyle way of life? After raging in local elections for years, that battle is now moving to May's legislative primary. Three Democrats, all hoping to win a seat in the NC House of Representatives, are facing off in the District 37 race, an election dominated by issues of affordable housing and infrastructure. Historically, District 37 is the most conservative in Wake. The predominantly white suburban neighborhoods in this southern part of the county are home to upper and middle class families, farmers, veterans, and small business owners. Following the decennial redistricting in which the district borders retreated from downtown Apex and expanded north to Lake Wheeler Road, District 37 remains one of the few competitive districts in the state and is key in determining which party will control the state house. Democrat Sidney Batch narrowly won the seat in 2018 amid an upswell of support from anti-Trump voters, besting Republican incumbent John Adcock by just 940 votes. But 2020 was a different story, as Republican voters turned out in unexpectedly high numbers. The GOP took back the district, with Republican Aaron Paré defeating Batch by 3 percentage points. Republicans, who currently make up about 52% of the district's vote share, according to the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, will likely have an edge in the upcoming election, says Andrew Taylor, a professor of political science at NC State University. One reason is that Paré, the Republican incumbent, is running for re-election, and incumbency has its advantages. Another is the natural cause and effect of politics. Taylor says, midterms are generally unkind to the party that has the White House. Obviously, this is felt most dramatically in congressional races at the federal level, but it does often permeate down the ballot and affect state legislative candidates. You put those two things into place, and what is a competitive district on paper in 2022 at least makes it more favorable to the Republicans. The three Democrats in May's primary are Mary Bethel, an advocate for aging and disabled adults, Christine Kelly, a marketing manager at SAS and former member of the Holly Springs Town Council, and Elizabeth Parent, a server at a local restaurant, and a transplant from Washington State. The winner will face Paré in November. During her 2 years in office, she has opposed mask mandates in Wake County schools and supported a bill that would have prohibited discussion of systemic racism and white privilege in U.S. history classes. That was HB 324, which Governor Cooper vetoed. She has also expressed concern about the effects of the proposed U.S. 401 bypass on local landowners and farmers in Holly Springs and Fuquay-Varina. Bethel and Kelly are each longtime residents of southern Wake County, having lived in the area for 20-plus years. Both have seen their neighborhoods change with population growth, but their reactions to that change differ significantly. Kelly, a vocal opponent of the rapid growth in Holly Springs, was elected to the town council in 2017 on the promise of slowing construction, building up infrastructure like roads and water systems, and preserving trees and green space. After a bitterly divisive election, she got to work doing just that, trying to preserve the area's small-town feel and advocating for more community input on development projects. Bethel has a more proactive approach to dealing with growth, while she also feels steps must be taken to preserve the quality of life, as she writes on her website. She wants to help aging and disabled adults stay in their homes with home repair help and property tax relief. She also supports offering incentives or tax breaks to first-time buyers. She says the issue needs to be addressed not only by localities and the General Assembly, but also by the housing community, advocates, builders, and developers. There won't be easy solutions. But if we don't do anything, then people are going to continue to move out of the area. A lot of moderate-income and low-income people are finding it really hard to make ends meet. Bethel also wants to consider solutions like housing trust funds, affordable housing bonds, relaxed zoning regulations, building reuse and revitalization, and incentives for the construction of affordable housing. Bethel is a little more progressive than Kelly on issues of affordable housing, but ultimately, Parent blows them both out of the water. For Parent, a millennial and working-class mother, affordable housing is a top priority. Like many others, she struggled to afford a home and was only able to buy one with financial assistance. For her, it came in the form of a loan program for veteran families. Parent says she wants to expand a home loan program that was successfully used in Chapel Hill to a statewide basis. The Community Home Trust helps people purchase a home through an income-based loan. Parent also wants to ban foreign investment in North Carolina, a practice that has decimated the housing supply and sent prices skyrocketing. The ban would apply to out-of-state buyers who have no intention of making a purchased house their primary residence. Parent says, "I'm from the outside of Seattle, so I saw how that affected us firsthand. I want to incorporate things that other places have used as a potential solution to this affordable housing issue. Why can't we set the standard for other states?" Bethel, a kindly grandmother with a southern twang, is a fierce advocate for seniors and people with disabilities. She was a lobbyist for AARP for 10 years and worked for the North Carolina Coalition on Aging. Healthcare is among her top priorities, and she says the number one cause of personal bankruptcies in this country is medical debt. As many as 600,000 people could be eligible for benefits if North Carolina expanded Medicaid. It also would help our struggling rural hospitals. Bethel thinks there is a lot of momentum for the expansion of Medicaid, particularly because Republicans may be softening on the issue, she says. An expansion could bring up to $2 billion into the state's economy. Like the other Democrats running in District 37, that's an area with a large number of veterans and law enforcement officers, Bethel is in favor of reasonable gun reforms, like expanded background checks and red flag laws. Bethel seems like she might take a stronger stance on gun control if elected, however. She said during this forum, "I think our country is ready to talk about this more and make real hard decisions." Christine Kelly, a confident public speaker and energetic candidate, is on the same page as her primary opponents when it comes to issues like education and health care. But her plans seem more specific and actionable. At the candidate forum, Kelly discussed how she would work with Republicans by starting with a common goal. "We'll win some, we'll lose some, but we've got to keep trying," she said. On universal health care, she says the solution is to sit down and start somewhere. Bring in some universal health care provisions, as they did in other countries. You start, and then you make it better. She's also a strong proponent of building up infrastructure and transportation. During her time in the Holly Springs Council, Kelly supported the passage of a $40 million transportation bond. She also supported the adoption of tree preservation and historical preservation ordinances and helped ban the open carry of guns in public parks and government buildings. Kelly said, "The gun lobby that came to attack us was incredible," adding that their voices faded after the law was approved. "The common sense thing to do was the right thing." Kelly runs for state office after losing a bid for the Holly Springs mayoralty in 2021 when she was defeated by Sean Majewski by nearly 22 percentage points, a margin that doesn't bode well for her winning this House seat. And Elizabeth Parent has a unique, she's 28, she has a unique take on problems facing the state. As that former resident of Washington State, she's now seeing North Carolina struggle with many of the same problems her former neighbors did. That's housing affordability, weakening infrastructure, and the tech boom. She says, if we don't break ground on solutions like commuter rail now, we are going to be grappling with more and more congestion every single day as more and more corporations move here. She adds that public transportation would also help protect the environment and lower housing prices. She's passionate about protecting the environment. She wants to expand the state's recycling program, create algae farms to pull carbon out of the air, and take advantage of potential solar power inland and wind power offshore. She also strongly supports legalizing recreational marijuana, a move that massively boosted the state of Washington's tax revenue. She said during the forum, "Once we legalized marijuana, our public funding went way up." She's a survivor of sexual abuse and is also a very strong advocate for women's rights, survivors' rights, and mental health care. She is all for bodily autonomy, she says, adding she will vote to uphold abortion and LGBTQ rights. Ultimately, Parent says she is tired of politics as usual. "It's time to hold our politicians accountable," she says. "North Carolinians deserve results. I believe that it takes a fresh perspective and a new voice, not the same old, to break things up and say, hey, this is a problem." It takes one person who is passionate, proactive, and willing to have those conversations across the aisle to get work done. Now, Lena Geller moves us into the 4th Congressional District, which is being vacated by Congressman David Price. And it features a celebrity, a longtime local leader, and an energetic progressive firebrand. Who will follow? Nida Alam giggles and shows me her phone. She's on the Students for Nida TikTok page watching a video set to Alvin and the Chipmunks-esque cover of Taylor Swift's You Belong With Me. The 5-second video uses one of TikTok's most common formats where the subject lip syncs to a song and overlays text that sort of matches the theme of the lyrics. In this one, a UNC Chapel Hill freshman named Chase pairs the lyrics, "Sitting on a park bench thinking to myself," with a text that reads, "Being a true progressive that supports climate and economic justice." Then as a chipmunk, Taylor sings, "Hey, isn't this easy?" Alam's name flashes across the screen. Among the 8 candidates running in the Democratic primary for North Carolina's 4th Congressional District, Alam is the only one with a student-led TikTok account, she tells me proudly. Like New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whose name has been hashtagged in so many TikToks that, when totaled, videos with AOC have a cumulative 1.1 billion views, alarm excites young people. When Representative David Price announced in October he would retire after more than 30 years in office, Alama emerged as a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed replacement with a staunchly progressive platform that includes support for a Green New Deal and Medicare for All. She told the Indy upon announcing her candidacy last November, "I think it's high time for North Carolina to have a fighter." Alama is one of three front-runners in the congressional race. She's up against Valerie Fouché, a state senator with over two decades of experience in public office, and Clay Aiken, a former American Idol contestant and activist for children with disabilities with zero experience in elected office. The newly redrawn 4th District includes all of Durham, Orange, Person, Alamance, and Granville counties, and the northeast corner of Caswell County. As the region is solidly liberal, the primary will most likely decide the general election, though if none of the candidates receive more than 30% of the vote, there will be a runoff election on July the 26th. Alam and I are sitting in her dining room, which doubles as her campaign office. She opens her laptop to kick off a virtual phone bank, and I see Chase from TikTok, this time framed in a box on Zoom. Like Chase, most of the phone bank volunteers are UNC students who seem wildly energetic, despite it being exam season. As an icebreaker, Alam asks participants to propose a name for her baby. She had announced her pregnancy that morning, and after they drop a few suggestions in the chat, Khadija, Lex, Leia, she gives them a script and a list of phone numbers and sets them off on their own. The next day, the phone bankers joined 100 other UNC students, including basketball star Caleb Love, at a town hall on UNC's campus. As encouraged, most attendees wore green shirts to celebrate Earth Day and endorse a Green New Deal. Alam isn't much older than her student supporters. She's 28. She was born in Canada to Indian and Pakistani immigrant parents and moved to the Triangle at age 5 when her father got a job at IBM. She became a naturalized U.S. citizen in February of 2008. She grew up in Wake County, attending public schools, and went on to get a degree in sustainable materials and technology from NC State. In 2015, during Alam's last year of college, three of her best friends, Dea Barakat, his wife Yusor Abusala, and Yusor's sister, Razan Abusala, were murdered in their apartment in Chapel Hill. Barakat was a student at UNC School of Dentistry, and Yusor and Razan were Alam's classmates at NC State. Alam says, "The week they passed away, we were all supposed to go get our ears pierced together. We were still kids." While many, included Alam, viewed the triple homicide as a hate crime, all three victims were Muslim, federal authorities ultimately claimed they could not find sufficient evidence to categorize it as such and wrote the shooting off as a violent reaction to a parking dispute. And she says, "That's what really pushed me to realize that we need to start stepping up and speaking up, not just for the Muslim community, but for all communities that haven't had advocates for them in leadership spaces." Alam started a club called NC State for Bernie while she was finishing school, and after graduated, landed a job as a political director for Senator Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. In 2017, she was elected third vice chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party, the first Muslim American elected to the party's executive council, and went on to make history again 3 years later when she was elected to the Durham County Board of Commissioners, becoming the first Muslim woman elected to public office in North Carolina. Durham City Council member Javiera Caballero, who has worked alongside Alam for several years and recently endorsed her congressional run, says Alam is unparalleled in her ability to identify and draw attention to the issues of young people and underrepresented communities. Specifically, she emphasizes Alam's work in fighting for a living wage, drumming up support for food pantries during the pandemic and adding an immigrant and refugee affairs coordinator position to the county office, Caballero says. She has a lot of connections into communities that in a lot of ways people don't even know they exist. How do you serve communities like that if you don't even know they're around? In addition to Caballero, Alam has received endorsements from other local leaders, notable elected officials like Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar, and more than 20 organizations, including the Durham People's Alliance and Communication Workers of America. Her platform for the upcoming election builds on the issues she's championed during her years in office, including comprehensive health care coverage, a green energy economy, reproductive rights, and a $23 million minimum wage. She says, I just keep reminding myself, who am I doing this for? This isn't just about me getting a title. This is about all the people's faces that I'm going to bring with me. Valerie Fouché's hands are at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel, eyes fixed on the road. She says, we're going to make sure we don't make any sudden movements, preparing to switch lanes. It's the third time she said this while we've been in the car. She drives the same way she speaks, assertively and with measure. We're heading to the home of an officer who works at a local nonprofit, El Centro Hispano, and who asked not to be named, so we're calling her Rosa. Rosa has offered to give Fouché a tour of neighborhoods in southeast Durham, particularly those with new housing developments, to help deepen Fouché's understanding of the area's constituency. As far as the 4th District goes, Fouché is most knowledgeable of Orange County. She grew up in Chapel Hill during the 60s as the oldest of six children and the child of teen parents, and attended segregated schools until 6th grade. She graduated from Chapel Hill High as class president and studied at UNC Chapel Hill, ultimately leaving college after 2 years. Attending school while working multiple jobs was too much at the time, she says. Years later, at age 50, she returned to the university to complete degrees in political science and Afro and African American studies. Between those stints at UNC, Fouché worked for the Chapel Hill Police Department and volunteered at her children's elementary school. For a period of time, she would work 12-hour overnight shifts as a desk officer in the jail, get off at 7 a.m., and head straight to the school to help out in classroom. There, she witnessed firsthand the achievement gap between majority and minority students, motivating her to run for school board. She later became the first African-American woman elected to the Orange County Board of County Commissioners, then joined the North Carolina General Assembly, serving in the House and, most recently, the Senate. Two of Fouché's colleagues, State Senators Natalie Murdoch and Mike Woodard, spoke to me at length about Fouché's achievements in office. Murdoch, who returned my call, despite being sick because, quote, I'd do anything for Senator Fouché, highlighted her role as a champion of education and her work in passing legislation that banned child marriage, increased access to health care, and outlawed race-based discrimination against natural hair. I'll brag on her because she won't do it herself, says Murdoch. Woodard emphasized Fouché's environmental record. She's worked on bills related to water quality, sustainable energy, and cleaning up coal ash, and complimented her connection to her constituents. There I go again. Woodard says her knowledge of her district is among the best of any colleague I've worked with. She just knows her community so well. In addition to Murdoch and Woodard, Fouché has been endorsed by a number of other state senators, plus U.S. Representative G.K. Butterfield, North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein, the Congressional Black Caucus, and the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. When Fouché and I arrive at Rosa's house, we hop into a sedan and set off on an hour-long crawl around a dozen surrounding neighborhoods. As we circle through cul-de-sacs and parking lots, Fouché asks Rosa the same two questions again and again. Who lives here? and what are their most pressing needs? Rosa says, cruising through one development, the majority of people down this road have children, so they care a lot about education. Fouché asks, where are the activities? Noting the neighborhood doesn't have a park. Where can the children go for passive recreation? Rosa answers that there are plans to build a playground, but the plot of land is right next to a thicket of high-voltage power towers, so parents are worried about radiation. Fouché makes a mental note. We continue on our trek. This neighborhood is wealthy and white, Rosa explains. They have million-dollar houses, an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and food trucks on Wednesday night. The area has a high level of crime. Two girls were killed here in a drive-by, and it was never solved. These apartments are owned by slumlords. The residents are mostly black and Hispanic seniors, and they were hit very hard by COVID. When we pass a house with Valerie Fouché for Congress sign in the front yard, Fouché shrieks with delight. Back at her campaign office near downtown Durham, we sit down for a more formal interview, and I ask her one question. Tell me about your upbringing, which she answers, and then unprompted goes on to answer nearly every question on my list. She lays out her qualifications, discusses how her upbringing shaped her values, and walks me through her priorities if elected to Congress, reforming the criminal justice system, enhancing equity in education, implementing affordable health care, combating environmental racism. In a concise 20 minutes, she's clearly done this many times before, but when I ask her the one question she didn't preemptively address, her disposition starts to shift. After we order sweet tea, I ask Clay Aiken if he chose to meet me at the Blue Note Grill because of the symbolism of the restaurant's name. He's a Democratic candidate, Blue, and a famous singer, Note, who I'm going to grill. Unfortunately, he says, he's not that clever. He's just spoken to the Friends of Durham PAC in the adjoining event room, so lunching here made sense. He'd also been at Blue Note the previous night to sing at an open mic, the only time he's performed publicly in the past decade, aside from starring in a 2019 stage production of Grease. Obviously, I played Sandy. So. He was born in Raleigh in 1978. For the first 5 years of his life, he spent most of his time at his grandparents' house in Bahama, where he and his mother camped out to hide from his abusive, alcoholic father. When his mother remarried, they moved back to Raleigh. His family has lived in North Carolina for at least 10 generations, and most of his relatives are Republicans. But during the 1992 presidential election, Aiken grew interested in the values Democrats hold and invited Representative David Price to speak to his eighth-grade class. He was immediately sold, saying, "I gravitated toward the group that spoke up for the underdog. Democrats were the empathetic party who were fighting for the needs of others." While pursuing a degree in special education at UNC Charlotte, Aiken worked as a caregiver for an autistic boy named Mike. During his last year of college, he competed on American Idol, finishing in second place. After that, he returned to Charlotte to complete his degree and co-found the National Inclusion Project, a nonprofit committed to creating programs that allow disabled children to participate in activities with their non-disabled peers, with Mike's mother, Diane Bubel. Bubel says Aiken's dedication to the disabled community emphasizes how he would be a strong representation in office, saying, "As a small, tired minority community members, we needed a champion. That's who he's been for us, and that's the kind of representative he's going to be for District 4. In the years following Idol, Aiken also made music and traveled as a UNICEF ambassador. He largely retired from the music industry in 2014 when he decided to run for the U.S. House in North Carolina's 2nd congressional district, losing the election to Republican incumbent Renee Elmers. After losing her seat in the 2016 primary, Elmers is running for Congress again this year in the 13th congressional district. Aiken has received substantial criticism online from people who claim that unlike Alam and Fouché, who live in Durham and Orange counties, Aiken doesn't live in the 4th District. In a written statement, his campaign clarified that though the redrawn congressional map placed the district line 900 yards from his house, he has lived in the 4th District for the majority of his life and plans to relocate before the new map takes effect. After briefing me on his background, he takes a bite of baked beans and jumps into his priorities for the 4th District. Transportation, affordable housing, and education are the big three. Despite his lack of experience in office, he seems informed on both the region's pressing needs and the political history, constantly referencing former elections and bits of legislation. He speaks at length about addressing the unintended consequences of Title I, a program that was wonderful on paper, but has, quote, incentivized certain school districts to create high-poverty schools. When I ask Aiken about LGBTQ rights, mentioning that this seems to be a central part of his platform, if elected, he would be the first gay man from the South to join Congress, he shakes his head. He tells me, I haven't focused on it simply because I don't want people to think that that's why I'm running. And gosh, it's a little sad that you did. It's an important issue, he adds, but he's tired of being seen as a single-issue candidate. At county party meetings, when others have announced that they would be the first this or the first that, he says he comes close to labeling himself as, quote, the first person over 6 feet who lives on my street to be elected to Congress. What sets him apart is not his identity as a gay man, he says, rather, it's his desire and ability to combat increasing political polarization by collaborating with representatives across the aisle. Aiken describes his opponents as more focused on activism than action. We need action and attention and intention to actually get some shit done, he says. He loves expletives. Over the course of our two-hour meal, he curses dozens of times, always dropping his voice to a low whisper, but mouthing the words dramatically. The words he won't say are Madison Cawthorn and Mark Robinson, whom he calls he who shall not be named, and you know who. He likes to punctuate statements by saying, and you can quote me on that. For instance, he drops the phrase after stating that Alam is not a terrorist, and anyone who says she is can kiss both cheeks of my ass. Most of all, for a celebrity, Aiken is exceedingly normal. When our server asks for a picture with him, for a moment I forget why she would want one. One of my earliest memories is watching Aiken climb out of a helicopter to throw the first pitch at a Bulls game in 2003, and it's hard to believe that this is the same guy. But his ability to pass as an average Joe doesn't negate the fact that, if it weren't for name recognition, his lack of experience would have likely quashed his ability to raise money and secure votes. Instead of running in this election, I asked, did he consider using his notoriety to throw support behind a different, more qualified candidate? He cackles, tells me I've been on Twitter too much, then says no, reminding me that he's the only candidate who's won a Democratic congressional primary before. And he says his fame is actually what will help him accomplish things with the opposing party. Are Republicans interested in talking to me about policies? He says. Not first, of course. They want to talk about American Idol. They want to take a picture for their daughter or their mother. But it's a way to get people to sit down and talk to you. After wrapping up the phone bank, Alam and I head over to a meet and greet at Durham City Council member Jillian Johnson's front yard, where Alam mixes with some 25 people as they sip cans of La Croix and snack on finger foods from Costco. This cohort of supporters is significantly older than the group I saw on Zoom, with most attendees looking to be in their 40s or 50s. As noted in a recent News and Observer article, it's important that Alam focuses as much on older voters as she does on young ones. If the primary leads to a runoff in July, many college students won't be in town to cast a ballot. at the meet and greet, everybody seems to be talking about the same thing. In hushed tones, they ask me if I've heard about the massive amount of money that the pro-Israel group AIPAC recently donated to Fouché's campaign. Many interpret the contribution as an attempt to prevent Alam, who has criticized Israel's treatment of Palestinians, from being elected, and view it as extremely concerning, given AIPAC's endorsement last month of 37 Republicans who believe the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Johnson says that up until recently, she saw Fouché as a strong second choice, but since the contribution from AIPAC, which she describes as a right-wing fear-mongering organization, she no longer holds this belief. She says raising money from the people you are asking to represent is a way of staying accountable to those individuals. So raising half of your money from a single source, it doesn't show that you have the ability to appeal to or represent a broad group of people. Attendees also discussed the Islamophobic polls that have been circulating online and conducted through phone calls, one of which asked participants to respond to a statement that describes Alam admiring a woman who, quote, showed support for a terrorist and was convicted of bombing a supermarket. Alam tells me that she's received a number of death threats during her campaign, probably many more than she's aware of, as there is an inbox that only her campaign manager can access. And her husband makes it a point to sift through their snail mail before Alam can see it. She says, these polls, they're just words, but unfortunately we know from this district having one of the most heinous Islamophobic attacks in recent history, people act in them. There are rumors that Fouché or her allies are responsible for the polls. In a written statement to Indy, Fouché's campaign refuted these allegations. The statement reads, they are not polls from our campaign, and we have no knowledge of where they are coming from or who is paying for them. That said, if we saw an ad on any platform that used that kind of rhetoric or language, we would denounce it and call for it to be taken down. According to FEC reports, Aiken has raised the least amount of money from the three frontrunners, of the three frontrunners, with $445,000 in pocket as of April 1. Fouché, with deep roots and years of public service, has raised $480,000 and the second most. And Alam has raised the most money so far, $657,000. While Fouché's large individual donations are the most localized of the three, people associated with Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill are two of her top contributors. More than half of her quarterly funding came in the form of bundled local and non-local individual contributions from AIPAC, which led to a Twitter firestorm from local progressives and caused the Progressive Caucus of the North Carolina Democratic Party to pull its endorsement. In addition to AIPAC's bundle of donations, a super PAC called Protect Our Future recently spent more than $800,000 on advertising for Fouché. Protect Our Future is backed primarily by Sam Bankman-Fried, a 30-year-old cryptocurrency billionaire. That PAC has also spent roughly $11 million in support of four other Democratic House candidates, including Ohio Representative Chantel Brown and Georgia Republican Lucy McBath in their bids, Georgia Representative Lucy McBath in their bids for re-election. When I ask Fouché why she hasn't denounced the bundled contributions from AIPAC and outside spending by Protect Our Future, she stiffens in her seat. Fouché is not a woman who likes any sudden movements, and though the questions don't seem to catch her off guard, it's also not one she's had much experience answering. She thanks me for giving her an opportunity to share her side of the story, then says she wishes money was not so crucial to running campaigns. She says, I've never had to raise funds to this extent. It's a thing that black women in particular are not very successful in raising capital. She doesn't comment on the support from the crypto billionaire. She just learned about it a few hours ago, she says. Regarding AIPAC, She says the organization supports her because of her position on Israel, which is fairly mainstream. She believes we should be working toward a two-state solution, but also that Israel should have the ability to defend itself. She says, Israel has been an ally to this country for more than 70 years with keeping peace in that area, the most volatile area in the world. She feels like a scapegoat. A number of other state Democrats have accepted donations from AIPAC, including State Senator Jeff Jackson and Representatives Deborah Ross and Alma Adams. And she's also frustrated that the contribution is overshadowing her lifelong commitment to progressivism. She says, it's very painful to be painted as something I'm not. I was fighting for a progressive Congress before those folks on Twitter knew how to spell progressive. After this line, Fouché steps out of the room to gather herself. When she comes back, there are tears in her eyes. This may be successful in having me defeated in this election, she says, but they won't stop me from serving. Now, this is a dense issue with a lot of things, and one of them is the IndyWeek's voter guide and their endorsement issue. And there are some individual articles and some small articlettes, but I will start with reading the full page of their endorsements for every vote, state and federal, Wake, Durham, and Orange County. And we just start at the top. For U.S. Senate, Democratic recommendation, Sherry Beasley. No endorsement for Republicans. In fact, as I look through here, I do not see an endorsement for any Republican. And so I will just mention most of these as their Democratic candidates. So again, U.S. Senate, Sherry Beasley. U.S. House District 4, Nida Alam. U.S. House District 13, Sam Searcy. NC Court of Appeals, Seat 9, there's no endorsement. Seat 11, no endorsement. Seat 5, no endorsement. NC Senate, District 13, Lisa Grafstein. NC Senate, District 18, 22, no endorsement in either. NC Senate, District 23, Greg Meyer. And Rosa Gill in District 33. In District 37, the Democratic primary we just read about, Elizabeth Parent. District 40, Joe John. District 50, Renee Price. NC House District 56, recommended Jonah Garson and Alan Buansi. NC House District 66, Sarah Crawford. In the Court 14, NC District Court 14, Seat 1, Dave Hall. Seat 3, Kevin Jones. Now to county officers. Wake County Board of Commissioners, District 1, Donald Mial and Sean Pollins. Board of Commissioners, District 3, Cindy Sinquez. Wake County Sheriff, Willie Rowe is given the endorsement. Wake County District Attorney Damon Chetson. They're not endorsing anyone at Cary Town Council at large at all. Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry. Durham County Clerk of Court Archie Smith and Amina Thompson are both endorsed. For Durham Sheriff Clarence Burkhead. Durham Board of Education, District 1, Emily Chavez. District 2, Bettina Umstead. District 3 on the Board of Ed, Matt Sears. Natalie Beyer on Board of Education, District 4. And District B, Millicent Rogers. For Superior Court, District 15, Seat 1, no endorsement. And in Orange County, the Orange Chatham County District Attorney, two endorsements, Jeff Neiman and Kaylee Tabor. For Register of Deeds, Mark Chilton. For the Board of Education, Sarah Smiley and Ashley Wheeler. And finally, for Carborough Town Council, Eliasar Posada are endorsed. Now, again, this article I just read you was a one-page just list of the endorsements. The a large part of the Indie Week print edition and online is a little more, a couple of paragraphs, let's say, on each of their endorsements and why they chose to make them. And you can find those online at indieweek.com. In fact, that's where I'm going to go for my next story, because it's one that has filed too late to be included in the print issue. And this is by Lena Geller from Orange County. A new project will expand high-speed broadband and access to thousands of homes and businesses in Orange County. Ultra-high-speed fiber internet, roughly 28,000 homes and businesses, including more than 9,000 sites that have never had access to high-speed before. After years of persistence from residents and local leaders, Orange County has solidified a plan to expand this service. The project will introduce, et cetera, as I said. As Indy reported last year, almost 100% of residents in Chapel Hill, Carborough, and Hillsboro are able to meet the FCC's minimum fixed broadband speed benchmark of 25/3. That is 25 megabytes per second for downloading data and 3 per second for uploading. But in the rural northeastern section of Orange County, the number of locations meeting that threshold drops to as low as 41%. Disparities in high-speed broadband access have long been an issue, but when the COVID pandemic mandated that residents use the internet to attend school, go to work, and socialize, the digital divide came to the forefront. Orange County Commissioner Earl McKee said in a news release, "Broadband isn't a luxury item. It's an essential need for everyday living. What we've learned in the past 2 years is that high-speed internet is vital for improving educational success for children, for public health, and for public safety, to grow small businesses, and for our residents who may need to work remotely." McKee successfully petitioned the Board of Commissioners to create an Orange County Broadband Task Force back in 2020. Using $10 million in COVID relief funds from the federal American Rescue Plan Act, the project will be implemented by partnership between the county and North State Communications. North State CEO Diego Anderson has emphasized that the new infrastructure will not only increase broadband access to underserved areas, but also provide residents with the fastest internet currently available, saying in a release, "This project will be life-changing." Over the next few weeks, North State will begin installing nearly 1,000 miles of fiber in Orange County. A service is slated to start in some locations by spring of 2023. Another brief article, this one from Durham by Sophie Horst, filed April 25th. On a recent Saturday, nearly 100 shotguns, handguns, and assault rifles of all shapes and sizes were unloaded from police vehicles outside of Durham County's detention facility. Some were rusty muskets that looked straight out of the Revolutionary War. Others were sleek black pistols with added metal devices, making the gun fully automatic and equipped to kill quickly. Most ominous of them were of all were revolvers with shiny metal barrels that conveniently don't drop shell casings when they're fired. Michael Taylor, a member of District Judge Pat Evans' community outreach team for her re-election campaign, pointed at one of the revolvers. "That's the murder weapon," he said. The assortment of guns had one thing in common. They had all been bought back from Durham residents by the sheriff's office April 9th. In the county's ever Bull City gun buyback, the sheriff's office offered Visa cards as a compensation, $100 for a shotgun, $150 for a handgun, and $200 for an assault rifle. At both Mount Vernon Baptist Church and Durham County Stadium, residents could bring their guns in for a financial reward. The buyback event officially began at 2 p.m., but by noon, Cars had lined up and down the block at both locations. The event was scheduled to last until 6 p.m., but by 3 o'clock, 1 hour later, the officers had run out of the rewards gift cards at both locations. In 1 hour, they bought back nearly 100 firearms, giving away $10,000 worth of cards. At each location, deputies turned more than 40 people away after they had run out. One man brought in 13 guns. Taylor said if someone had broken into his house and robbed him, that's 13 guns hitting the streets. Lieutenant John Pinner stated, "I was thinking if we got 10, that would be amazing. I'm stunned." The buyback event was organized by Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead in partnership with Evans. Both Burkhead and Evans are running for re-election and are on the ballot in the May 17th primary. The buyback process was anonymous and voluntary, and there was no limit to how many guns an individual could turn in. The press release from the sheriff's office stated, "No questions will be asked." Guidelines for the event were straightforward. Individuals were instructed to drive up in their vehicles, making sure their firearms were visible, so deputies could then retrieve the guns. Participants were compensated only for firearms that were operational. Evans said some people gave us their guns even after we ran out of cards. Evans, a former lawyer with Durham County DA's office, has lived in Durham for 39 years and served as a district court judge for the last four. Fighting gun violence in Durham is one of the main promises of her re-election campaign. She proposed the buyback event about a month ago as a way to get guns off the streets. She noted that gun violence has been especially bad. More than 1,900 shooting incidents have occurred in Durham since the start of 2020, wounding 650 people and resulting in nearly 90 deaths. The sheriff's office will catalog the guns collected during the buyback event, then keep them for 6 months and issue public notices to verify that there are no legal owners who wish to claim them. Then, Evans will sign an order to have the guns either destroyed or used for training purposes. After both locations ran out of gift cards, the guns were brought to the detention center and loaded onto two large carts. Evans posed triumphantly behind them for photos. As Taylor recorded her on his iPhone, Evans said, "Thank you for Durham for joining us and taking a hold of our vision to make Durham a safer place." She said another buyback day may take place later this month. Many residents who brought guns after organizers had run out of cards want to come back next time. And she said taking guns off the street is only a first step. She favors additional solutions that address the root of the gun violence problem. "It's not just enough to take guns," she said. "We need to replace them with jobs, mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, with tools for people to have a sustainable life." All right, as time permits now, I've got 5 minutes left, and I'll begin with a food and drink article about a Kerry micro bakery called Bad Oven by Gabby Mendig. "In parking lots across the triangle, you'll find Peanut De La Cruz warmly greeting customers. Some regulars have by now become friends. Other shop customers are first-timers. All, however, receive beaming smiles and hugs as the Kerry baker hands out bags of coffee cookies and the ubi latte buns from the trunk of her gray Hyundai. De La Cruz is a one-woman force behind Bad Oven, an online micro-bakery specializing in Filipino sweets that she founded in October 2020, just as restaurants were being devastated by the pandemic. Despite this, the small bakery has managed to thrive and even take on a minor cult appeal. The Bad Oven system is simple. Customers place orders online for weekly pickup at outdoor locations in Kerry, Raleigh, and Durham. The routine of the model, it turns out, is exactly what customers have sought during the pandemic. And it also suits De La Cruz's needs. Scheduling around her first-time marketing job at an internet publishing company, she bakes limited quantities in her home kitchen, where she's unencumbered by some of the regulatory barriers to entry faced by large-scale food business. And for De La Cruz, who moved to the U.S. from the Philippines in 2017 and settled in North Carolina 2019, Bad Oven has been a wonderful introduction to the Triangle. She says, I had no idea what to expect from North Carolina. The people that I've met so far, they've all been so welcoming. Like I have not met a single asshole. Personal connection is central to the bakery's appeal. She says people at that time were longing for human interaction. She does her part to facilitate these connections using social media, which is where many customers initially discover Bad Oven. When customers make the leap from social media to in-person pickups, she encourages them to pose for photos and boomerangs when they pick up their orders. Often, in a sort of chain reaction, the photos shared on Bad Oven's Instagram page are reposted by bakery loyalists. These faces of the Bad Oven community have become integral to its success. The business De La Cruz recognizes with a laugh is definitely not scalable. There's only so much time in the day, and she only has two hands. Bad Oven goods come in limited quantities and are in high demand. A seasoned regular knows to set an alarm and be at their computer when the clock strikes 8 on Tuesday night. It can take first-timers several weeks to learn the ropes, having repeatedly visited the shop website at 8:10 p.m. to find everything was already sold. As the most beloved Bad Oven item is the purple bun. The bun, pandesal, is yeasted and slightly sweet Filipino bread roll. Several years ago in the Philippines, a modernized version became hugely popular. It's dough-flavored and filled with ube, a variety of purple yam. The unique flavor, as De La Cruz describes it, has earthy notes of vanilla and taro. It's so beloved at Bad Oven that De La Cruz has made the bun into a character, creating a fully-fledged personality named Ponpon. Her communications background is evident across Bad Oven's online content, which is alive with lighthearted, eye-catching graphics. The coffee buns take on a personality of their own, adorably branded with a sad face. For all its deliciousness, this micro-bakery is more than a bakery. It is a micro-community. No traditional food business brings people together such that individuals hang around parking lots, chatting, swapping ramen recommendations, or offering to help change a flat tire. And John Feddersen must turn off this edition of Indie Week. The podcast is available, of course, on ncreadingservice.org. And until next week, when I hope to be back with the next weekly issue, John Feddersen bids you all happy week. Happy week, indeed.